You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
David Mitchell has been compared to everyone from Leo Tolstoy to Thomas Pynchon, and two of his previous novels were shortlisted for the Booker Prize and won many other prizes. Many critics have called his latest novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, his best yet. Dave Eggers wrote in the New York Times Book Review that it confirms Mitchell as one of the more fascinating and fearless writers alive. His book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings the fascinating and fearless David Mitchell to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your program.
Your previous novels have been described as experimental, postmodern, genre-bending, but this one seems to be a fairly traditional historical novel, at least in terms of its structure. What happened? Did the book just concept of the book just demand that?
It did. I found out about this what was to me an extraordinary place, Dejima, a trading post run by the Dutch East Indies Company for the whole of the 240 years that Japan was closed off to the outside world. But it ceased to be in the 1860s, so of course it had to be a historical novel.
Does it still exist?
It's being restored as a museum, Leonard. So if you do like the book, you can now get yourself to Nagasaki and walk the street if you wish.
Now, this is an island that was actually created so that foreigners would not walk on holy Japanese soil?
Effectively, yes. And I use the word island. It was, but not one with hills or woods on. It was very, very small, just about a third of an acre, made in the same way that Amsterdam was, just as you sort of hammer piles into the seabed, and so it's an artificial island, and it was walled. The Dutch weren't allowed off, and the only three types of people allowed on were the merchants to do the business, the translators who, and that was a father to some business that got passed down the generations, and apparently very, very expensive prostitutes.
Ironic that they were using a technique similar to what the Dutch did and only allowing the Dutch on this island. Mm-hmm. Now, why the Dutch? Earlier, hadn't Portuguese missionaries gone to Japan?
Yes, indeed. The Portuguese and the Spanish. And they had converted large numbers of Japanese to Christianity. But this began to make problems to such a degree that, in fact, there was a sort of a Christian-fomented rebellion, and that really alerted the authorities to the dangers of this this foreign religion. So almost like a virus, they wanted to keep it out of the country, and the walls went up. The Dutch, however, weren't interested in converting souls. They were just there for the money, and that was much more acceptable to the authorities.
Well, there'd been a long period of stability under the last shogunate. So was that part of it? They just didn't want to mess things up, keep things going the same as they'd been?
In a way, the long period of stability happened once the outside world was expelled. This highly successful dynasty for the best part of 2.5 centuries ruled the roost. And in a way, validated the original suspicion that if you want to keep control of power and to keep change out of the country, you have to very, very tightly control what's coming in and what's going out.
Your title character, Jacob de Zoet, is a young clerk with the Dutch East Indies Company. Did they really monopolize the trade? Why were they allowed, you said earlier, simply because the Japanese trusted them to only want to engage in trade?
The Japanese trusted them and the English. The English couldn't make it pay because they spent all the money, it would seem, on prostitutes and not on making money. They were given permission by the first shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu. Mm-hmm. And after his death, he became deified. But because it had been him, it was impossible to overturn his word. And so the Dutch effectively had trading permission from God. The power of tradition in Japan is very, very strong, and that was never challenged really until the 1840s, 1850s, a long time later.
We have this novel beginning in 1799 and it ends in 1817. So the change didn't when was Japan finally opened up to the rest of the world?
Starting in the 1840s and moving to the 1850s when the treaty ports were opened.
And then all hell broke loose and Japan became a modernized country within 50 years or so.
It did, in part because it had never really been in complete isolation because of Dejima. It always kept open this little cat flap into the outside world through which knowledge about what was happening and what happened to non-white countries that got too technologically far behind could enter Japan, which is really why it could go from being a feudal state in the 1860s through to something that could take on the Russian Navy and win in about 40 years. Extraordinary, really.
In the book, you include a wealth of detail about the sights, sounds, and even smells of the place, as well as the daily life of the men who lived there. How did you research this era? Did you find historical accounts? Were there letters or journals written by employees of the Dutch East Indies Company?
Yeah, just so. They're all kept at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, and I went there and spoke with some archivists and some academics. That's the hard research, where you find things out for the first time you maybe can't find anywhere else.
And then you had to translate them. Or do you speak Dutch?
The Dutch speak excellent English, as you may know. And then, of course, when you're writing the book, you just to finish the end of a sentence, if someone's shaving himself, for example, you then have to go away and research when shaving foam was invented or how would a middle-class man have shaved himself in 1799. So it never really stops until you finish the last sentence of the book, actually.
Poor Jacob is an honest and naive soul, and he has a hard time dealing with all the corruption and theft going on around him, both by the Dutch and the Japanese. Were things really as wild as you suggest?
Oh, yeah, I think they were more wild than I suggest, really. It's a universal theme. What does an honest man do in a nest of vipers? Well, this was actually the year, on the stroke of midnight of 1799, the Dutch East Indies Company actually ceased to exist and had been. It was a long, slow death, but it happened because everyone in the organization was on the take, except for a small number of poor souls who had kept it going as long as it did.
And I'm sure, and they were the ones who were treated with great suspicion.
Like Jacob.
David Mitchell is my guest. His latest novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, it is published in this country by Random House. It's interesting that the Japanese interpreters are some of the most powerful people on the island and also the most corrupt, because having the ability to translate between the two cultures gave them a form of political power as well?
It does. Language is power. There's Party E. Party A doesn't know what Party B is saying. Party B doesn't know what Party A is saying. And the translator is the bridge. And Party B won't know if the translator isn't telling the truth, is mistranslating.
So much of this novel is about the interaction of two cultures that don't always understand what the other one's about.
Almost never. In the beginning, I thought this would be a problem, but the more I got into writing the book, I realized this was a resource I could capitalize on.
Now, you mentioned the Dejima of wives who were basically prostitutes, I guess. So how did they wind up on the island? Were they imported to act as girlfriends to these Dutch traders?
They worked for the best brothels in Nagasaki. They were the most expensive prostitutes in Nagasaki because the Dutch couldn't exactly go shopping to a cheaper establishment down the street. Often they were actually the daughters of previous unions between Dutch men and Japanese women.
So they'd be Eurasian in many cases.
Yeah, in many cases.
Did they ever get married?
It depends what you mean by marriage. No. They wouldn't be allowed to leave Nagasaki, so they couldn't really have an ordinary life.
Jacob is engaged to a girl back home, but he soon falls in love with not one of these women, but a young Japanese midwife who's studying with the Dutch doctor in Dejima. Were women able to study medicine in Japan at the time?
Probably not. However, that probably gives a novelist enough of a just enough of a crack in the door to get his foot in. My wife warned me when I started writing the book. My wife happens to be from Japan, and she warned me that if I wrote yet another book where there's a beautiful, rather dim geisha who just swoons at the feet of someone who's tall and blonde and foreign, just because they're tall and blonde and foreign, I can't really repeat what she on live radio what she threatened to do to me, but it wouldn't have been pretty.
Erito is not the type of girl to become a Dejima wife. So Jacob Wooser, by sending her a dictionary, would that have been a precious gift for someone like her?
It would have been invaluable. She's the daughter of a doctor, of a scholar, and one of Dejima's uses. It was a book source. The Enlightenment was happening, of course, in Europe throughout the 18th century, and for the first time, medical breakthroughs. Earlier, Newton, science, whole new areas of human study, economics, etc., were coming into Japan. First being understood in Europe for the first time, then entering Japan, but there was no way to understand them. We're in an age before dictionaries. There wasn't a Japanese dictionary or a Japanese Dutch dictionary, anything like that.
And the growing mood toward democracy grew out of Enlightenment in Europe, and Dejima. The men debate the merits of democracy, was a big topic at the time because of the U.S. and French revolutions.
Yeah.
Was that one of your major interests here, closed societies and the struggle between them and the forces of liberation?
It's one of my interests, and it's one of the book's interests. Of course, from the Japanese point of view, this idea, democracy, sounds absolutely absurd. How could it possibly work? And I'm interested in these jarringly different worldviews and what happens when they meet.
In the second part of the novel, the action shifts to a very strange monastery in the mountains where young women are held prisoner for decades and forced to bear children for the monks. Did such places exist?
I'm happy to say that that is a product of my fevered imagination. Oh.
And your wife didn't object to that one?
She hasn't read that part yet.
Did you see Dejima and the monastery as similar in a way? Aren't they both insular worlds, almost prisons?
Yes, they are. Yes, they're walls. Walls are good news for narrative because human neuroses have nowhere to go. They must stay inside the walls and bloom and bear their strange fruit.
Each of your novels has been a radical departure from the last. Is this a matter of constantly changing, challenging yourself to do something different?
Yes. I want to keep working as a novelist until the day I die, and I need to think about why there are so many more people writing novels in their 30s than in their 60s. And I think one reason is that you can sort of end up getting caught writing and a series of variations of the same novel.
In fact, that is the conventional wisdom, that's what writers wind up doing.
That may be the case. I don't want it to happen to me.
Well, in her review of this book, Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times wrote, it's as if an acrobatic but show-offy performance artist, adept at mimicry, ventriloquism, and cerebral literary gymnastics, had decided to do an old-fashioned play and in the process proved his chops as an actor. I don't know if you took that as a compliment.
I will take it as a compliment. Yes. I haven't been reading the reviews, so that's the first time I've heard that. And it's sure.
But she can be rather mean and sharp-tongued. Do you know what the next novel's going to be?
I do, but in this day and age, I'm a bit nervous about talking about
it. Oh, I wasn't going to ask you to tell me.
It gets on Wikipedia, and then I'll have to change it later when I change my mind.
Have you started already?
Yeah. It's always good to start before the publicity for the last one starts up, so I can remind myself that I'm a writer and not a rather strange traveling salesman.
And I assume you'll go back to it after the tour is over.
Oh, it's on my laptop in my hotel room, actually, so I'll go back to it this evening.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, David Mitchell, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I suspect another book or nomination, perhaps even a prize this time.
Don't mention the B word. We don't mention it in my house.
I know. last year, one of our guests had been called the front runner for the Booker. And when I mentioned that at the end of our interview, he said, you have put the you've definitely put a curse on me, and sure enough, he didn't win. David Mitchell's The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
David Mitchell will be reading and signing books tonight at Book Court. That's at 163 Court Street in Cobble Hill. And then he'll be reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7 at Greenlight Bookstore, accompanied by Dutch-Japanese fusion cuisine and a sake tasting. That's at 686 Fulton Street in Fort Greene. A lot of Brooklyn here. And he'll be reading on Sunday at 3 p.m. at 192 Books. That's at 192 10th Avenue in Manhattan. For more information about all those events, go to our show page at WNYC.org. Up next on Please Explain, Dr. Brian Fallon and Dr. Carolyn Britton discuss Lyme disease, how it's spread, how you can treat it, and why the number of reported cases has been climbing in recent years. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.